Argument, United States v. Turner. Mr. Lenio?
Yes, Your Honor.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Mark Lenio, and I represent Appellant Daryl Turner. Mr. Turner was charged with seven counts of drug dealing offenses as well as possession of firearms in connection with those offenses. The issue I would like to address today is his sentencing and conviction on the 924C, two counts of 924C. For the crack cocaine sale and maintaining a crack house, Mr. Turner received a sentence of 240 months. He also received a 13-month sentence for being a felon in possession of a firearm. Consecutive to those two sentences was his conviction on count two for 924C. He received a 60-month sentence. The second 924C conviction yielded a sentence of 300 months as being the statutory required sentence. In total, his sentence roughly was 51 years. 30 years of his sentence relates to those two 924C convictions.
But they're both a function of statutory minima, right? So 360 months of this whopping 613 months is a function of the statute, unless we were to agree with your argument that somehow we haven't correlated a different firearm to a different, you know, offense, right?
There were two controlled buys in this particular case, which occurred involving the same two defendants. Mr. Turner and his brother were operating this crack house. Mr. Turner, in fact, had, prior to the commencement of the trial, had pled guilty to counts 1, 3, and 6. Those were all of the drug dealing offenses. He had not pled guilty to the assault of the witness, which was count 7, or counts 2 or 4, which were the 924C charges. I think in this particular case, it's important to look at the particular facts of these two controlled buys. The first controlled buy occurred roughly at 10 a.m. on January 30th of 2003. On that case, Mr. Ross was wired by the police, went to this apartment in Michigan City. He then purchased 5.8 grams of crack cocaine on that occasion. Mr. Ross indicates that he saw Mr. Turner with a revolver in the waistband of his pants. Later that same day, the same police used a second confidential informant to make another purchase at the same location, and that was Mickey Shipp, and that dealt with count four. And that was about four or five in the afternoon of the same day at the same location.
But how can that be one predicate act if it's two different people, even? It's two different moments at which he chooses to engage in this behavior, and it doesn't really look like the cases where there are a couple of guns associated with one buy.
If you look at the factual sequence, the two buys in the same day, and the fact that police then, after the second buy, immediately went to get a search warrant. They obtained a search warrant and were back at 6:30 the next morning, whereby they did a search, found the two weapons. It's apparent that what happened here was the two weapons were there in the residence the whole time anyway during these transactions. There's no evidence in the record that either Mr. Daniels or Mr. Turner at any point left the residence, thereby obtaining, say, a second.
But why does it have to be two guns? Suppose he sells, just to make it a little bit different, he sells some crack on day one, and he has a particular gun, you know, maybe the .38 caliber weapon that he had. And then 4 days later, he sells some more crack, and he has the same .38 caliber gun with him then. He could be convicted on two different counts.
He could.
Because it's the same gun. The point isn't the number of guns. The point is the number of transactions.
Right, and I guess when we look at this situation, it could be a situation where if we're talking, say, a situation involving a street-level dealer, street-level dealer might have a weapon on on him, sell somebody one rock, 10 minutes later sell somebody another rock, two 924Cs and 30 years added on sentence for, let's say, one rock, a relatively small user-type quantity. And this second sale was, in fact, a very small amount.
Yeah.
It was 0.68 grams. That 0.68 grams resulted in an additional 25 years sentence added on. So when we're looking at proportionality of the wrong and the conduct here, I think it's a little out of whack in terms of the particular sentence.
Do you want to say something about Booker? Well, your time has expired, but if you have something
I think the 924C argument is my primary argument, and I would rest on that, Your Honor.
Okay,
thank you.
Mr. Grimmer?
Yes, Your Honor. Good morning. William Grimmer on behalf of the United States. First of all, in terms of looking at the argument here, the government would indicate with respect to the 924C, the lesson of CAPAS, at least that was before the district court, and we've argued, is number one is you look at the jury instructions, and number two is you can perhaps make an argument that the evidence firmly excluded the possibility that the jury relied on similar type of evidence. Here we have two different guns. We have two different times, although it was on the same day. We have two different predicate acts. In fact, the defendant himself told the jury that he had pled guilty to do two different distribution counts. We have two different informants, Mickey Shipp and LaRon Ross. We have two different, although the drug was the same in terms of it being cocaine-based, there were two different amounts. Along those particular lines, I believe if you look at the jury instructions, which CAPAS tells the court to do, I think the jury instructions that are found on page 504 and 514 of the transcript that were embodied in the court's final instructions, 11 and 27, clearly gave the jury the direction in which to proceed as far as that they were separate counts to be considered separately. If for some reason the court decides that the instructions weren't sufficient, we would ask the court to extend or at least go into that territory that CAPAS talked about, because clearly here there was no question that the defendant himself who took the stand talked about committing two different crimes of distribution, those involving LaRon Ross, and I think specifically he admitted to doing that, selling the dope, the cocaine to Mr. Ross, and indirectly admitted as well that he sold it later on that day to Mickey Shipp. I am on the same ship, apparently, that other government counsel has been before the court today, and there is a Booker issue here, and I would be remiss if I did not at least talk about it. In listening and looking at the brief, the supplemental brief that was filed, and looking at the cases in preparation of this argument, I understand what the court's concern is. When do we get to a plain error that would require remand? I don't believe that this is the case, or this particular case merits a remand. Although it's not argued strenuously here, I think the court raises some concerns about what, in fact, would constitute plain error. Here, Judge Miller, in our supplemental brief, indicated that the bottom end of the guideline range was 235 months. Ultimately, Judge Miller sentenced to 253 months, and, of course, there were the additional firearm convictions. I think in terms of when there would be a need for a remand, if an argument had been presented below by defense counsel That, in fact, there was a mitigating factor, something that rises under 3553A or that was precluded by the guidelines. It might be a situation where if the district court also as well indicated that it felt constrained not to consider that particular factor and, in fact, sentenced at the minimum, might provide some kind of a guidepost for this court in determining whether or not that fourth prong is affected. I would indicate that in looking at the cases that are coming down, it appears that some circuits are making a per se rule that simply because if, in fact, you were sentenced under the guidelines, we find that the fourth prong has been met and we're going to have a per se plain error rule. And we would, the government at least, would urge this court not to establish a per se rule like the Second Circuit, I believe, has done.
Well, then the only alternative seems to be some mush. You have an alternative?
Well, just what I indicated is if, in fact, if the court, if there has been an argument made below on the record by defense counsel as to mitigating circumstances that were that the district court was precluded from.
But there might have been mitigating circumstances barred under the guidelines, and that's why it wasn't argued.
Well, right? I think you have to make your record. I mean, I think if defense counsel, good defense counsel, makes that record.
No, that's why we're talking about plain error.
Yeah, that's why we're talking about plain error. And I'll tell you what's already happening as a result of zealous applications of plain error elsewhere. We're seeing more and more briefs where defense counsel are having to waste a few pages saying, we're just preserving this utterly frivolous point just in case the Supreme Court one day decides to reconsider it. And I'm not going to give examples because I don't want to, you know, for all I know, the Supreme Court will reconsider some of these things. But when you force people to put these things in, kind of just in case one day, you know, maybe loose, you know, what that we were talking about, it's very inefficient and unfair, actually, for defense counsel to have to waste space in briefs, you know, cataloging everything that the Supreme Court one day may take another look at.
Well, I would encourage this court to look at the holding in Rodriguez out of the 11th Circuit. I think that's a reasonable alternative to some of the decisions coming out of the 2nd, 4th, and 6th.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Grimmer, Delenio, have anything further?
Nothing further.
Okay, well, thank you very much. Last case for argument, United